monetize introduction. You now have a working product with users, but you're not making money yet. Together, we'll try apply business models on different parts of your product to see what users will pay for. Why is monetization so important? It seems too obvious to even ask, but these days, in the world of startups, it's actually seldom you see any company make any real money. After Hollywood movies, the startup narrative has become so incredibly jinxed that you now have millions of people following a dream of becoming a billionaire by programming away while eating pizza and sleeping in the office. Who cares about money, right? We'll become billionaires someday. But most people don't. So that's why, especially now, it's more important than ever to focus on monetization. Monetizing a startup early on is the best thing you can do for yourself, your friends, family, society, and pets. More so, if you're never able to monetize your app, you'll never be able to turn it into a business. You'll always be stuck doing maintenance on it for years to come. You'll never be able to hire someone to take over the work so you can focus on the long-term strategy of your company. Wait, no. It won't even become a company if you don't charge users for it. You aren't running a charity, you're running a business. If people won't give you money for your product, you have an existential crisis on your hands. Josh Pigford, founder Bear Metrics. Don't be afraid to charge money. One of the most common problems I see with makers these days is that they're so incredibly scared to charge any money for their apps. They make something, launch it, get people who use and love their product, and then are afraid to scare them away by charging for it. The problem is, if you never charge for a product, it'll never become a real business. It'll remain a side project forever. That's fine, but you'll have to maintain it forever too. That costs time and money. And the whole point was to make a business, right? So start today and call 1-800-STARTUPS. Just kidding. Don't be afraid. People are happy to reward you for your work. And if your product really improves their experience of life even a little bit, people are happy to pay for it. But those people will only be a small percentage of all the people that are happy to use your product for free. What I mean is, if you have 1,000 people using your product actively, don't expect more than 5% to pay for it, probably fewer. So your paying customer base is fewer than 50 people. Here's the challenge. A side project can be successful with 1,000 users, but it won't be a business with 1,000 free users. You need 1,000 paying users. That means you'll need a side project that would have 20,000 potential free users. Think about this. That means not every project is monetizable. And if that's your goal and it's not reaching that scale, then it's probably best to shut it down and try again. Don't waste your time. Charge money, get hate. Here's another thing that you wouldn't expect you'd get, but if you start charging for a product, you'll get hate. Internet hate. A lot of it. There's an interesting subculture on the internet of people who presume everything should be free. Because Facebook is free too, right? These people are the problem. People will go on Reddit and other internet forums and write about your app or site and simply attack it with posts like, "How dare he charge for a simple Facebook scheduler APT by GrumpyCat2019. I can't believe what just happened." So anyway, I was feeding my cat and then I was trying to find an app so I can schedule my social media posts. I really put too much time into scheduling this, so I need an app. So I found this app, MediaScheduler2000.com. Okay, so I sign up. And what the hell? I have to pay $25 a month for it? Who does the maker of this app think he is? What a capitalist. He's just making easy money over the backs of others. This should be free. It's always these big companies trying to make money off of the little people. Even Gmail is free. Don't support this app. The maker is evil. 1-1. You'll get this a lot. And it's fine. Don't lower your prices. Don't make it free. These people are not your customers. These people will never pay for your app, not even if you lower the price. And it doesn't matter that they write about you in a bad way, even if they get a response from others. There's enough sane people who do have money to spend and who'd love to spend it on your app. They will not whine about your price on internet forums. Instead, they'll pay you. That's your customers. Build with monetization in mind. This may limit your creativity, but I strongly suggest you build with monetization in mind early on. especially if you don't have a lot of cash flow now and actually need a project to give you some revenue, to literally pay your bills. If you do have lots of cash flow and runway, you can experiment more. If you don't have monetization in mind, it can often lead to more interesting projects that might also have more interesting ways to monetize later on. It just won't be as clear in the beginning. That's fine if you don't need to make money quickly. Here's the interesting thing, though, which you see with both entrepreneurs and artists alike. Often their best work was when they were constrained by resources. Musicians usually make the best and most authentic songs when they were poor. Entrepreneurs made their best apps when they needed to make something successful, and there was pressure to pay their bills. Here's a test. How many entrepreneurs you know who became successful and rich, and then made a second project that also became as successful? It's fairly rare. And it's because success changes people's life. They are no longer, financially, dependent on the success of a project. They already have had money and success. Often the chip on their shoulder of, I'm going to show the world I can do it, is gone. Also, having money gives them too many resources. They'll over-engineer a product, and since they're now in a small minority of successful people, they're not the target customer anymore either. That's why the position you're probably in now, where you're heavily bound by resources, is a competitive advantage. You can much more easily compete with big entrepreneurs than you think. You're pure and real, probably more than I am now. I'm jaded already. Your limited resources make you creative. It gives you a very clear goal and a strong focus. Monetization is validation. In the last few years, we've seen monetization become not just more important for startups as venture capital money runs out. We've also seen it become a validation tool in itself. If people are willing to pay for a product early on, it gives it good odds to succeed later. Because one person paying for something means you just need to find thousands of other people like that person and also make them pay for your product. A famous example of validation by monetization is Buffer. They started with a landing page that described their product, and they added a plans and pricing button. Once people clicked on there, they discovered there wasn't actually a product yet. They could add their email to get a message when the app would launch. This was 2011, a long time ago. My own iteration of this idea is way more direct. Add a buy button if users click it, show an actual credit card modal where they enter their details, they click pay. Then you show an alert. Sorry, we didn't charge your card, but thanks for your interest. Our product isn't done yet, but we'll let you know when it is. This means the user actually was about to pay, but they couldn't because your product wasn't ready yet. If you log how many people actually complete this process, you can make a rough estimate of how many people would pay per month and how much revenue you'd have. And you know if it'd be worth to fully develop the product or feature in terms of how much it'd cost you and how much revenue it'd make. This type of validation is way better than just having a landing page without a product where you might get 10,000 visitors. You know nothing about the intention of these 10,000 people. They might not even like your planned product. Business models. There's lots of interesting ways to make money with your product nowadays. I'll discuss the most popular ones now. Limit features to paid users. One of the most common and obvious ways to monetize is limiting features for paying users only. You make your app with every feature you want in it, launch it, then see what people use extensively and which features they value most. Figure that out with analytics or talking to users or just intuition. Pick those features and test if you can make them for paid users only. Keep them available in your product's interface, but once people click, tap them, show a pop-up POC modal that reads, to use this feature, please upgrade, upgrade. Then as soon as possible, push them to a payment window before they change their mind. Now you have a paying user. This is powerful as the emotion involved here is, oh wow, I'd like to use that feature. To I have to pay. To okay, how much? To $5 is not that much. Okay, whatever. It solved my problem. It's not the most fun emotion, but it works if you make the conversion fast and smooth. After they pay, immediately enable the feature and let them use it. Done. Pay per feature. You can do this in many ways. You can let customers unlock lots of features at once. You can even let them become paying subscribers. More on that later in this chapter. Or you can make each little unlockable feature a single payment. For example, $5 to use the sharing feature, $10 to add a world map. Whatever, really. I actually think this paper feature model has lots of potential, and I'm surprised more people aren't trying it on the web. You see it in native iOS or Android apps a lot, especially in games. You could do the same for web apps, charge per feature that the users want to use and price accordingly. Either the most popular features could be the most expensive, or you could charge a lot for the features that are more custom and niche. Both models can work. Ads. The online advertisement is in quite a difficult place, and it's put it there itself. Their ads are so bad and so full of malware and viruses that we've all started to install ad blockers. And if we don't have ad blockers, well, we just don't really click on ads a lot anymore. Again, because they're so shit. Ads these days are annoying, ugly, and spammy. We can't even stand ads on television anymore, so we'd rather pay Netflix $9.99 per month and watch that instead. We can agree that traditional ads don't make any sense anymore in a time where we decide what we want to do, watch and listen to. We don't want to be interrupted by a voice that tells us to buy something we don't want or need. We're Generation Fight Club. Is there any future for advertisements then, if everybody is sick of them and blocks them anyway? Yes. They're called native ads. Native ads are ads that don't necessarily come from some big ad network like Google. You write, design, and sell them yourself and customize them so they fit with your entire product's look, feel, and most importantly, objectives. If you have a site for travelers like I do, and a bank comes up to give advertise with high-interest predatory loans, I'll immediately say no, because it means I'm making my user's life a lot worse. If there's a tool that travelers can use, and I would use, I'll happily let them advertise if they pay me. So it's about having ads you'd like yourself, that are actually helpful, and that don't look and feel out of place. Joe Rogan's podcast is a good example of another product which maintains the same strategy. Joe only advertises with products he'd use himself, and he tells about them in his own way, without a script. That's native too. Do native ads pay well? It depends. For me, they pay a lot better than Google AdSense does. Let's say I'd install Google AdSense on Nomadlist today. I'd get an ad like this. Firstly, it looks ridiculous and spammy. Google pays about $1 for 1,000 views of this ad. With 500,000 views, I'd make $500 per month. That's not a lot for a site my size. Secondly, it's not extremely relevant. Sure, it's a hotel booking ad, but how about something my users actually need? I think they already know how to book a hotel by now. Instead of using Google Ads, how about I talk to a company that is really interested in travelers and they have a product that closely fits with my audience, such as a high-tech backpack, or a VPN so people can always connect to the internet securely, or a laptop stand that travelers could use to work remotely and not get back injuries, or a remote work company like Automattic who recruit remote workers. In that case, I could do a native ad. Hint, it's the Automattic one. There's a few things that are different here versus the Google ad. This native ad is friendly, honest, and simply designed. It fits the look of my site. The topic fits the audience of my site. And it pays 5x to 20x as much, e.g. $2,500 to $10,000 per month, as the Google ad because I make a custom deal with the company instead of getting resold through an ad network. Guess what? My users are happier seeing native ad than an ugly-looking Google ad that most of the time doesn't make any sense anyway. It makes my site look more classy, and I make more money. Happier users, happier advertisers, higher conversion, and you make more money. What about ad blockers? Well, since it's a native ad, it's custom, it's hard to block. Plus, because the ads are truly relevant to the audience, users won't despise the ads and want to block them, generally. Native ads don't even have to look like ads. They come in endless shapes and sizes. It simply means you connect your audience to a company that fits and where both your audience and the company gets a positive result from it. Congratulations. You've just created value for everyone. One important note. Always specify a native ad is in fact an ad by writing on it, sponsored or ad. If you don't, you'll be breaking advertising laws in many countries. Sponsorships. A popular model, especially with open source projects and small side projects, is sponsorships. You make something that many people find very useful, and it aligns with a big company's mission. If you get some attention for your project, a company might ask you, or you can ask them, to sponsor you. This could be a fixed amount per month so you can cover the costs of keeping your product up and, of course, continuing to develop it. In return, a company might not require anything, but mostly they'd like to have their logo appear on your site or about page. Which companies should you aim for here? Well, companies with lots of venture capital money in the bank that look to grow and get more brand awareness are a good target. If they don't reach out to you, send them a short email introducing your product and how it aligns with their mission. See if they'd like to sponsor it for $250 to $2,500 a month. If you get four sponsors at $250 a month, you're already profitable enough to keep yourself alive somewhat. Patronage. Patronage is a more recent and very interesting model that's only going to get bigger in the future. Patronage originates in the Middle Ages when artists were paid by royalty to live in with them and paint their daily lives. They made portraits of them, but also scenes and landscape paintings of important events. Pretty much they were the digital camera for kings back then. The good thing is, it allowed artists to get fed, get a roof, and stay alive. On the side, they could work on their passion of making real art, kind of like a side project. Fast forward a few centuries, and patronage is back. In our case, it means that if we're a creator, illustration, musician, artist, or just a maker, you ask the people that like and use your work for money, directly. Usually your work stays free, but you simply ask for monthly donations. Many people struggle with this because it comes across as begging, but these days it's a bit more classy than that. People are less afraid now to say, I want to work on something cool, but I have bills to pay, so help me. There's a few platforms for patrons in different industries. The main platform is Patreon, which is mostly focused on creatives, but now branching out into journalists and even game and software makers. We're now also starting to see patronage in apps itself. A good example is Marco Arment, who made a podcasting app called Overcast. The app itself is free and very good, but after you've used it for a while, it'd ask you, do you want to support Overcast development? It gives you the option to pay several different amounts of money, either recurring or not, through an in-app purchase. Strikingly, the in-app purchase doesn't unlock any new features. That's typical for patronage usually. It just means you're now a supporter of its development. The feeling itself is what you pay for. This is incredible in so many ways. Just the fact that you don't need to somehow trick people into unlocking features, but can ask them straight up, hey, do you like this thing I made? Support me making it, please, is magical. I don't think this would have worked a decade ago. The issue is that asking users for money to support development goes against the idea most of us have been brought up with about entrepreneurship. You make a great product, there's demand for it, and people pay for it. If people don't pay, it probably means the product isn't good enough, as the market judged it and didn't want to pay for it, right? With patronage, you make a great product, people use it for free, and those who feel a personal connection and are fans of it will pay you for it. This also means apps that are so niche and would never get enough audience to be profitable to develop suddenly become economical to build, as long as you can get enough people to just support its concept. Personally, in the early days of Nomadlist, I actually tried this model, and it worked really well. I had a sign-up page on Typeform, and I'd ask, people these days understand you are a human and need to pay your bills, like them. And many are probably increasingly attracted by an authentic request for money than a big marketing page with flashy buttons to unlock the full version of your app. It was an honest and frank request for money. It worked and people appreciated it. It wasn't a big sales page like I have now. It was just very basic. Patronage has its time and place, and for me in the beginning, this made sense. Now I feel I can make more money by in fact selling it as a big product. But patronage bootstrapped the first year of Nomadlist. When it makes sense for you is up to you to judge. I'd try it for sure. Subscription-based memberships. If you've heard about software as a service, commonly abbreviated as SaaS, you know why subscription revenue has become such a big deal in recent years. If you don't, it's the idea of offering your apps, not for sale, but for a subscription that keeps going, like your television subscription. If people stop paying, they also can't use your app anymore. In return for paying, you keep maintaining and updating the app and give them customer support. Subscription or recurring revenue is somewhat of a holy grail for entrepreneurs. Let's see why. We assume we have 1,000 customers per year and they pay a single payment of $75, or in the second model, a subscription of 75 year. Single payment $75, subscription 75 year. Year 1, $75,000, $75,000. Year 2, $75,000, $150,000. Year 3, $75,000, $225,000. Year 4, $75,000, $300,000. Year 5, $75,000, $375,000. What if you have a growing business and sales grow by 25% each year? Single payment, $75, subscription, 75 year. Year 1, $75,000, $75,000. Year 2, $93,750, $168,750. Year 3, $117,187, $379,687. Year 4, $146,484, $854,296. Year 5, $183,105, $1,922,167. See how fast recurring revenue grows? Obviously, this is without people canceling a subscription. That's called churn. Let's be pedantic and add churn of 7% per year. That means 7% of users cancel their subscription yearly. Single payment, $75, subscription, 75 year. Year 1, $75,000, $75,000. Year 2, $93,750, $163,500. Year 3, $117,187, $356,430. Year 4, $146,484, $777,017. Year 5, 183, 101,005, 1,693,897. See, even with a moderate churn, it'll still grow much faster than a single payment does. After 5 years of single payments, 25% annual user growth, and 7% churn, you'll be making 1,693,897 of revenue versus only 183,105 if you use single payments. The difference is 1,510,792. Recurring revenue is very powerful. There's a very good reason why entrepreneurs like this. It's easy to sell a company like this. Acquiring companies love subscription revenue as it's highly predictable and relatively stable. If you know the growth rate and the amount of people canceling, you can evaluate the company easily and in turn value it with a good price. From the customer's perspective, subscriptions might not be that great though. People spend much more money generally. They often forget to cancel their subscriptions and then they renew for another month or year, meaning they overpay. It's hard to get that money back then. Actually, forgotten subscriptions are the elephant in the room of subscription-based businesses, with some assuming up to 50% of subscription revenue are by customers that don't even use the product anymore. Obviously, subscription business owners are the last to discuss this. It's their cash cow. But it's dark. A solution to this would be to specifically ask people to renew their subscription or not after you detect they're not actually using your product but are still paying for it. Nobody is doing this, though, that I know of yet. Obviously, it'd instantly make the subscription model more healthy for users and still beneficial for businesses. What should you offer as a subscription, though? Well, anything, really. Your app, a service, a forum, a chat group, a social network for a specific niche, like I did. Most apps people repeatedly use work with subscription revenue. You might see a drop in sales, though, when switching to subscription revenue because subscriptions require commitment. And not everyone wants to commit to another subscription in their lives, besides Netflix. This depends heavily on your audience. Personally, I have become a bit tired of signing up for another subscription. A good middle ground that I use is to offer, besides subscription, also a one-time payment lifetime memberships for the predicted lifetime value, LTV, of a customer. That means if you know on average your users remain members for 2 years and you charge $100 a year, your lifetime membership will be $200. That means you'll make the same amount of money as with subscription, they just pay the entire amount up front. Community model. Subscription payments work especially well with the business model of building a community. What's a community? It can be a discussion board, forum, chat group, social network to physical meetups. I do all of these with Nomad List. Communities are attractive business models, because by default, they're niche. You make a community for travelers or motorbike enthusiasts, people who have horses, fans of Ariana Grande, whatever. There's endless niches to serve. They're also attractive because if you become the dominant community in your niche, you have a monopoly and you can charge high prices. As with social networks, communities have the famous network effect. The more people you have in a community, the more valuable it becomes and the more money you can charge. Each user usually has a profile like this. Operationally, communities can be run quite lean because community software like forums is quite maintenance-free. You might need a moderator, but that's it. On the other hand, you can go as big as you want. I started with a chat, but now have a forum, a location-based social network and physical meetups all over the world. The model is also highly relevant to current time. People don't like to pay for content anymore, but they do like to pay for connections, e.g. communities. Tech makes people more lonely than ever, but it can also connect them to more people than ever. Your community can enable that. The story of NomadList's paid membership community. In my case, I built a community around digital nomads and travelers, and I did it mostly accidentally. I had launched NomadList as a list of cities with some data on internet speed, cost of living, and weather. It then went viral, but the site was very basic. I knew I was going to lose all these users because when you go viral, it only takes a few days or so and you're gone. I knew to make them stick, I needed social features, but I couldn't code fast enough to build social features into my site, like signing up, logging in. I thought, okay, let's just use other platforms for it for now. Back then, Slack was just taking off, 2014. I invited some of my friends to seed the community. I also added a big banner to the top of the site so that people could sign up for free back then. A month later, I added a discussion board running on Discourse. I could have never built a chat and forum myself this fast, so it made sense to use off-the-shelf tools. My trick had worked, the social stuff had made the site a bit more sticky, and it was actually getting more popular. After a few months, I started getting lots of spammers in. The quality of users decreased due to volume. So I thought, I'll just start charging $1 to remove spammers. It worked, the spammers were gone, but the quality of users was still not so high. I raised it to $5, then $25. Every time I raised the price, I'd see a drop of users for a week, and then it'd go back up the same level of signups. I doubled it to $50. With 10 people signing up per day, suddenly I was making $500 per day, or $15,000 per month. I had no idea what I just did. I wanted to stop spammers and increase the quality of user signups. I did that. But I also suddenly monetized my site, and within days it became a profitable business. Many people have followed this concept since and done the same. You have a free basic app or site about a certain topic. People who visit your site probably have the purpose of taking action based on what's on your site. And because they're on the internet, they probably don't know a lot of people in your niche. You provide free content, attract people, and then sell them a way to connect with people like them in your niche. By building a community around your site's niche, you give them a valuable service, and you're able to monetize your audience instantly. You can take this model and apply it to expats, illustrators, 3D modelers, coffee baristas, Apple product fans, etc. I like this model because it's valuable for you, your free product gets monetized with a community, and for your users, they get connections out of it. Job boards. This is similar to the community model. You have a free site about a certain niche. Does that niche have its own industry with people working in it? Like designers, developers, baristas, expats, anything really. If so, one of your best ways to make money with it is to open a related job board besides it. Job boards work because companies pay a lot to find the right talent to work for them, especially tech companies. You charge companies to post a job, like $49 or $99. $199 or $299. If you get just 10 job posts at $299, you're making almost $3,000 a month. That's just 10 customers. Job boards are B2B, so you need relatively few customers and high prices to become profitable. A good example is Dribbble, which lets people share their creative design works in a show and tell-like platform. But they make zero money on this. All their money comes from their job board. A job post costs $299 for 30 days on Dribbble Jobs. They get about 5 per day. That means they might be making 1,500 day or 45,000 month or 540,000 year. Start to see the pattern? You build something that's free, which generates traffic, and then add something that's either valuable to your users or businesses that target your users, and either one of them will pay for it, which lets you keep your free site up, which in turn generates more traffic when you work on it. Conditional payments. This is another interesting model that I tested myself. With my app, Go Fucking Do It, I asked people to set a goal, specify a deadline, and enter their credit card details. If they did not reach their goal by the deadline, I charged their card automatically. This is interesting because users don't specifically pay for a service or good. They pay for failure. It uses money as a disciplinary tool. I'm sure there are lots of ways you can evolve this model. One fitness app did this by adding GPS and charging you if you didn't show up at the gym every week. So think of other ways how you can evolve this model. It simply means the user doesn't necessarily pay for a product or service, but you use their money in a different, more unique way. Productizing an agency into a SaaS. This is not directly a monetization strategy, but still important to discuss. Many startups started as creative agencies. That means they built a product for a single client, but then transformed that into a standalone product or service, usually a software as a service or SaaS. A great example is Typeform. It was started by David Okuniev, who was working for a client at the time. Typeform was born out of a client project that required us to build a lead generation form that would sit inside an exhibition space for a toilet company. We had to create something more inspiring to collect data than just a plain old vanilla form, so we tried something completely different. David Okuniev, founder of Typeform on inbound.org. An even bigger example is Basecamp, previously known as 37 Signals. They started as a simple web agency in 1999. 37 Signals started as a manifesto in 1999. We wanted to launch a web design firm that was focused on clean, fast, usable designs, and our manifesto was a series of statements covering our feelings about web design. In 1999, everyone else was elbowing for the loudest, brightest, most colorful, techiest, full-service, end-to-end site. We went the opposite direction. Jonathan Kim on Quora. A decade later, they had so much experience working with clients that they started noticing commonalities between the problems they were solving for them. They started building lots of small side projects to solve them. Most of them failed or were sold, but now their only product, Basecamp, remains. Some people now estimate their revenue at $168 million. That means a small web agency productized their clients' problems into a million-dollar company. An important side note here is to remember to make sure you own the rights to the work you make for a client so that you can actually transform it into a business later. Otherwise, they'll be the owners of your future million-dollar company. Learn from your competitors' business models. When you can't figure out any model that will let you make money, it's always a good idea to see how your competitors are making money then. In general business theory, to compete with someone, you either raise prices and sell a better product, called the premium strategy, or you lower prices, undercut them, and sell an equal or lesser product, but cheaper, by reducing costs, called the low-cost strategy. See how Android took 80% of the smartphone market with a low-cost product, while Apple took the other 20% of the market with a premium product. Apple makes more money with only 20% of the market than Android smartphones with 80% of the market. Crazy? Yes. The point is, in most markets, there's room for both a low-cost and a premium product. Keep experimenting with business models. One of the best things you can do is, and that I haven't seen many others do yet, is to continuously experiment with models to make money. When launching a new product, I'll usually put a buy button on it immediately, just to see what happens. I'll make some part of the site exclusive to paying users, or offer a service to businesses to reach my users in some way, and I'll keep putting those buttons everywhere, because then I can see what people are willing to pay for. I'll test prices, raise them, lower them. You'll quickly see what works and what doesn't. And you can keep doing this perpetually to figure out any new monetization models that may appear. When are you done monetizing? This depends heavily on your objectives. For many people, making just $2,000 a month is a lot. I know it was a crazy lot of money when I started out. But you have to consider income tax, corporate tax, insurance, and costs like that. It adds up. How much are you left with after costs and taxes? Maybe $100-$200 a month. Can you live off that? You'll probably need to make some more if you want to save money for the future too. A business is risky. It might work for a year and then stop working altogether because the market changes. It depends on your objectives. It's also about how far you'd like to go. And your personal situation is as much a consideration as the potential of your business to go that far and scale up. Scaling up will take high resources from you too and will reduce the time you can spend with your lover, family, and friends. It's always a trade-off. How big do you want to be? Do you think your app should remain a side project, or do you think it should become a real business? Should it be a big company with hundreds of employees? Do you want to manage that? Then you need a lot more revenue. Look at your competitors. You're probably able to estimate how much money they're making roughly with some back-of-the-napkin math. Are they venture capital funded? If not, how many people do they employ? Make a calculation of how much it costs to employ those people. Add some overhead and you'll know a minimum of revenue they're making, if they're profitable, that is. If you get the same amount of users or traffic as them, but you're making way less money, then there's obviously room for improvement in your monetization. If you get less users or traffic than them, figure out where they're getting their users from: Google, Facebook, referral traffic from certain websites. Map it out like a secret spy agent and see if you can compete with them in their own funnel. Widen your market. If you think you've already captured most of the market and it's saturated, see how you can widen the market you sell to. Can you make your product broader and less niche? While Nomad List started as a site for digital nomads, now half the users are general travelers and expats. That market is 1,000x bigger than the digital nomad market. Grow the pie. Another way to get bigger is to literally grow the market you sell to. In macroeconomics, we call this growing the pie. But that's on a national level. It applies to an entire market too. Most Airbnb users never rented vacation rentals before Airbnb arrived. Vacation rentals were a dusty old market for retirees. By promoting vacation rentals for young hip people, suddenly everyone jumped in and started renting them. This didn't just help Airbnb, it helped their competitors, like HomeAway too. They grew the entire market pie to be bigger by making people more aware of the industry. In turn, they were able to reach a lot more customers. Payment platforms. To monetize a site, you'll need to accept payments from your users. Luckily, in the last few years, there's been a lot of innovation in this industry. The dominant payment platforms, at time of writing, are Stripe, Braintree, and PayPal. Braintree is now owned by PayPal. It's always better to use a drop-in solution like these three than setting up some big merchant agreement with a payment gateway or bank for just your website. Even high-scale businesses like Uber and Airbnb use Braintree. Other companies like Lyft and Target use Stripe. And companies like Barnes & Noble or Abercrombie & Fitch use PayPal. Stripe. Stripe revolutionized the online payment industry when it launched in 2011. For the first time, it let people accept payments with an API that was simple, unlike PayPal's. They gave websites a drop-in solution where you could just add some code and immediately accept payments. You didn't have to fax or post 12 contracts signing your life away to a merchant payment gateway company, how it used to go. It just worked. Developers loved Stripe, and still do. Stripe is developer first, which means if you're building a website, app, or whatever software, they'll have some pre-written code for you to build upon their API. One of their easiest products for newbies is called Stripe Checkout, which lets you add a pay button to your site, which then opens a beautifully designed payment pop-up where people can enter their credit card and pay you. You then charge the user, get a signal back that payment went through, and you can give the user access to your product. Let's say you want to do subscription billing and a user changes their subscription from 25 month to 100 year in the 12th day of the third month they're a member. How do you calculate and prorate them? With Stripe, you don't need to. They have it all worked out for you. You just tell them you sign a user up to a new subscription plan. Then when they change it, you tell Stripe and they'll charge the right amounts. It's magic. With Stripe, you don't even store credit cards anymore. which makes you a target for hackers. They store them for you safely. All you save is a token, which lets you charge them money that can only go to your account, not the account of hackers, instantly making it useless for hackers to hack you. Depending on where you live, Stripe may or may not be available yet. They're expanding worldwide though now. For remote workers, it might be interesting to note they're available in Singapore, a popular place for people to register their companies when they're a nomad. Braintree. Around the same time that Stripe launched, it got a competitor called Braintree. It followed the same ideology. Make it simple and friendly for developers to implement their API. They are highly similar too. The greatest benefit to use Braintree over Stripe is that Braintree is available in a lot more countries than Stripe. This is probably because they're now owned by PayPal, which I think has banking licenses everywhere by now. PayPal. PayPal is one of the oldest and most famous payment solutions on the web, and that's probably why it's despised by so many. Its technology is highly archaic, outdated, its API is badly documented, and subject to unannounced changes at any moment, and until recently, their site looked and functioned like an Egyptian tomb. The great benefit of PayPal, though, is that it has very high conversion rates. That's because people usually don't have to enter their credit card information on your site, but simply pay by logging into their PayPal account. If you're North American, you think, why is this a big deal? Well, most of the world doesn't use credit cards like you do. For example, Dutch people use a weird customized debit card system called Cirrus. Latin Americans are culturally extremely afraid of using their credit card due to rampant fraud. And most Germans use cash or will pay by a bank wiring system called Sofort. That's a lot of customers you won't reach. PayPal enables those users to buy your product as they support most weird national payment systems in the world. And as people don't have to enter any payment details, it feels more secure to them. PayPal's buyer's protection usually favors buyers, which is bad for you, but great for users. All in, these factors increase the odds that people actually go through and pay on your site. Recently, PayPal has started to rebuild their site, launched a modern app, and are generally on a spree to quickly modernize after years of engineering stagnancy. This is directly because of Stripe entering the market. To fend off Stripe, they acquired Stripe's biggest competitor, Braintree, which they're slowly integrating into PayPal too. That's all good news for us makers, as there'll be more payment platforms to choose from. They're slowly catching up again. However, PayPal is not without its risks. Unlike Braintree and Stripe, which automatically deposit your balance either monthly or weekly, PayPal by default keeps all money in your balance. And they've been known to shut down PayPal accounts with lots of cash in them when they suspect fraud. They'll lock down accounts for weeks or months. If you use PayPal, make sure you log in at the end of every month and manually deposit your balance to your bank account. Don't keep a high balance of money on PayPal. It's a business risk. Local alternatives. At the time of writing, Stripe is available in America, Canada, Western Europe, and Singapore. Braintree is available in a few more. PayPal is available in many more. But still, there's lots of countries where there's simply no international payment processor. In that case, you'll have to consider local alternatives. That means doing lots of Googling and research to figure out which is easiest and cheapest to set up. It will most certainly be more complicated and involve signing more paperwork than Stripe, Braintree, or PayPal. But you have no choice. Stripe Atlas. An alternative is to open a company in a locality that does support Stripe. Stripe itself introduced a service called Atlas, which helps people from worldwide open a simple corporation in the United States and in turn lets them accept payments through that company. It might be worth investigating. Having a proper payment processor like Stripe will save you a lot of time encoding payment logic, refunding, and dealing with credit card fraud. Use a combination of platforms. Instead of picking Stripe, Braintree, or PayPal, you can also use a combination of the services. On many of my sites, I show a modal that asks users, pay by credit card, pay with PayPal. When one of these buttons is clicked, you link them to the appropriate platform. This gives your users more freedom to choose how to pay, and gives you a higher reach of potential signups. When I added this, conversion went up about 40% from $10,000 to $14,000 per month. Great, My bookkeeping becomes so difficult with PayPal that recently I switched solely to Stripe just to make my life simpler. That's the downside to it. Use a type form to charge fast. What if you have an MVP and you don't have the time to set up Stripe, Braintree, PayPal, or another platform's code on your site? You don't need to. Use Typeform. I talked about Typeform in the chapters about building MVPs before, and it's very useful in this case too. Typeform lets you connect your account to Stripe. That means you only need a Stripe account. You don't need to code anything. All you have to do is make a new form on Typeform, which asks the user for their name, email, and credit card information. If users enter and pay, Typeform handles everything and you'll directly see the money appear in your Stripe account. Now, if you have your MVP, you can simply add a buy button that's actually a link to the Typeform form you build, and you have instant monetization. If the monetization works and your model is validated, you can always build your own payment integration with Stripe on your own site without the Typeform. But a Typeform is a good start when you don't have time or want to code something yourself, especially if you're experimenting and validating what people would pay for. How to deal with refunds? After charging users, a percentage of them will not be happy with what they paid for, and it's usually a small, predictable, and stable percentage. The worst you can do when a customer asks for a refund is to not give it. You now have an angry customer. You don't want an angry customer because they will talk about you on the internet, and they'll destroy your product's brand. That means you'll get less future customers. When a customer asks for a refund, say sorry that it didn't work out, and mean it. Then immediately refund them their money. Ask them why your product wasn't what they expected. This might be one of the most useful moments to ask for feedback, as you might be able to avoid future refunds to other users. This is not a bad event. See a refund as a moment of critical feedback. It doesn't mean the customer will always be right, but it's important to listen. You'll learn more from your angry customers than your happy ones. Another big reason to give a refund as quickly as possible is that these days users can request a chargeback to their bank, sometimes within their bank's app. This is the last thing you want. Chargebacks are payment disputes between you and the customer's bank. They give your company a bad reputation with your payment processor, like Stripe, and they cost money. A regular chargeback means the entire amount they paid is refunded and you pay a fine of $35 usually. Now, as long as you provide a refund immediately, you just lose the money that they paid, but nothing more. The payment is already refunded and they can't initiate a chargeback, so it'll cost you less to refund. That's obviously why the banks have designed this system like this. It promotes refunds. Well, it's working. How to deal with bookkeeping and tax? If you've come as far that bookkeeping becomes a problem, you're probably doing well. Having thousands of transactions coming in from countries all over the world is challenging. Dealing with the right sales tax laws in states like US and countries like Europe is difficult. I recommend if you're doing over 50,000 year revenue to pay up to $5,000 for a good accountant that understands technology, business, and startups. Trust me, they're hard to find. Regardless of country, most accountants are old and behind. My advice is approach 25 different accountants and make them do a quiz. Ask them what, for example, Stripe is, how to do sales tax payments in different countries, and how they would help manage your thousands of annual transactions. Not having an orderly bookkeeping can become a very big liability and burden if you ever get audited. In most countries, fines are double or more of what you were supposed to pay if you didn't file properly. That can be a lot of money. Additionally, you'll be on a list at your governmental tax organization that you broke the rules before, so you'll probably be audited more now. This is not a part of business you want to save money on. Pay a bookkeeper well. You need them to operate legally in the complicated environment that having an internet presence where you sell worldwide is. Where possible, try to automate your side of the bookkeeping before it arrives at your accountant. That means set up automated webhooks from your payment processor, like Stripe, to sync transactions automatically to a Google spreadsheet or database. Don't forget to also sync stuff like refunds. You want a ledger of all transactions that is always up to date. For expenses, you'll want to save every single invoice you pay to a Dropbox folder with the file name format. Expenses, YYYMMDD. Company, description, USDX XXXX PDF. Try to limit your income and expenses to as few mediums as possible to make your bookkeeping more simple. I only get money via Stripe now, and I spend it via PayPal or my business bank account card. That means I only need to dump 3 data sources to get 100% coverage of my transactions. Remember, it's hard to get your bookkeeping perfectly accurate. You have an accountant to help you with that and see if everything is done properly. Keeping your finances simple should be priority. Conclusion. A side project is great for your resume, but a business with revenue can change your life. If it works out, it means you can quit your job. You can hire people or robots. Get an office or work remotely from anywhere. It means you might be able to build a movement out of your vision. And that can all start with a small little project. Everyone starts small. If you grow or not often depends if you can make money and feed yourself and the company. Money is like rain on plant seeds. It gives it nutrition to grow. Money makes it possible to keep working on your project and pay your rent. If you don't make money, your project will stay small, and you'll be bound to stop working on it and quit. If you'd like your project to become big, please focus on monetization. Remember, an app without monetization is a charity. An app with monetization is a business. Resources mentioned. Patreon is Overcast, Slack, Discourse, Dribbble Jobs, Typeform, your homework. From the business models mentioned in this chapter, make a list of which ones might work for your product. Pick one to start with and implement it. See if you're getting payments after a few days. Keep adjusting until the model works. If you're certain this model doesn't work for your product, ditch it and try a different one from here. Repeat until you're generating revenue.